September 12th. But I think this is the upside of Telecosm, and we've got a thrilling program tonight to open up the conference. I met Ray Kurzweil at the White House in the mid-1980s, where we both received awards for entrepreneurial excellence. And Ray had actually earned his award by launching several companies and inventing OmniFont optical character recognition, a reader for the blind, a synthesizer for Stevie Wonder, and a whole array of wonderful products, and then managed to sell his companies to Xerox and other Learnout and Houseby, and all. You know, he was a real entrepreneur. I got my award for writing books that the president liked, but I felt pretty good about that. But then Ray invaded my field massively, and with a whole series of amazing books, beginning with The Age of Intelligent Machines, which predicted almost to the day the time that a computer would defeat the world chess champion. And he went on to write a whole series of other books. He innovated in literature with these wonderful dialogues at the end of his chapters, which are just wonderful to read and reach a new climax in his current book, which is called The Singularity Is Near. Now, I don't really agree with that proposition. I think the singularity is here, and here he is, Ray Kurzweil. Thank you. Well, we realize that the singularity is here, but not everybody in the world realizes that yet. So it's going to take a few more years till word gets around. This book, which you should have in your bag, in large measure actually stems from the last Telecosm I was at, which I think was the second one, 1998. We gave out actually pre-pressed versions of a subset of The Age of Spiritual Machines. And then we gathered in the bar, and I sat down with John Searle, and then Bill Joy came by and said, "Can I join you?" And so we had a spirited debate, John Searle and I did, about can machines be conscious, and can machines really emulate the full spectrum of human intelligence? And Joy was listening eagerly to this. He hadn't really heard this kind of conversation before. He then read the book. Now, in that book, I talked about both the promise and the peril of technology, because in my earlier book, The Age of Intelligent Machines, I just talked about the upside. I actually did that consciously because I was aware of the potential for bioengineered biological viruses. I didn't want to talk about it because it was not in the public domain at that time. I didn't want to give the wrong people the idea and turn on the TV and hear somebody say, "Oh, yeah, I got the idea from Mike Kurzweil to unleash this thing." But they had... By 1998, there had been movies like Outbreak, and so I talked about the promise and peril of these technologies and came out on the side of promise, but actually very concerned about peril. I think we'll make it through, but I'm not as confident that we'll avoid all painful episodes. We certainly didn't in the 20th century. So I talked about that in The Age of Spiritual Machines, which has been known as an optimistic book, but that's actually where Bill Joy got his somewhat dystopian views, and he went on to write Why the Future Doesn't Need Us, the sort of famous Wired cover story, which people have interpreted to advocate relinquishment of broad areas of technology. He actually says, no, that was not the case. He just is advocating controls. Our positions are actually only different in subtle ways, but we've been paired as optimists and pessimists, respectively, on a lot of panels. John Searle and I also started our debate at that barroom conversation at Telecosm 1998. And so those debates actually animate this book that you'll see. So it's, I think, very fitting and gratifying to actually announce that or launch that here at Telecosm. It actually launches officially today. And this book is the sort of culmination of my thinking on this topic that I began about 30 years ago. I actually got into technology forecasting because of my realization that timing was a critical factor in inventing. Your invention has to make sense when you finish a project, not when you begin the project. Invariably, people either make that mistake, or even if they realize it, don't have really adequate models of how technology evolves. So I became an ardent student of technology trends, and I began to track it informally, and then being a scientist and engineer, I began to collect data, build mathematical models. This has taken on somewhat of a life of its own. I have a group of 10 people that methodically gathers now key measures of technologies in many different areas, and we build mathematical models of how technology evolves. And I have used this to time my technology inventions. Most technology projects fail because they get the timing wrong. They don't fail because the R&D department can't get it to work. We get a lot of business plans now. We do a certain amount of investing and mentoring. And 90% of these plans, it's quite apparent if these projects were funded, they would succeed in doing exactly what they claim they will do. But 95% of these projects will fail because the timing is wrong. And Google was in the right place at the right time with the right approach. Timing is really quite crucial, and most people get that wrong. But these sort of technology forecasting activities have taken on a life of its own, in that I can now, or have been, using them to forecast not just 3 or 4 years out, but 10 years, 20, and 30 years out. And I say this now not just sort of overfitting past data now looking backwards, but I have been doing this forecasting now for 25 years. And George mentioned my first book, The Age of Intelligent Machines, which I wrote in the mid-1980s. We had most of it written when George and I met in 1986. And I've had hundreds of predictions about the 1990s and the early 2000 years. For example, the ARPANET, which nobody had heard of, was used by a few thousand scientists, had 10,000 nodes in 1 year. And it went in 1 year to 20,000 and then to 40,000. Still not a very significant phenomenon. It was clear that doubling would continue. So it would be 10 million going to 20 to 40 to 80 million in the mid-1990s. And then would be on everybody's radar screen. So it looked to the casual observer like the internet came out of nowhere in the mid-1990s, but you could see it coming. And it brings up an important issue, which is, can we predict the future? The common wisdom is, well, you can't predict the future. And that's true if you talk about specific projects. If you were to ask, well, will Google stock be higher or lower than it was 3 years ago? Will it be higher or lower 3 years from now than it is today? That's hard to predict. What will the next wireless standard be? What will the role be of WiMAX, CDMA, G3, or some other standard? Very hard to predict those precise windows. But if you were to ask me, what will the price performance of computing be? How much will a MIPS of computing cost in 2010? How much will it cost to sequence a base pair of DNA in 2012? What will the spatial and temporal resolution of brain scanning be in 2014? I can give you a figure from these models, and they're very likely to be correct. And you might wonder, well, how could that be? I mean, if we can't predict a single project, how can we predict the overall result of lots of unpredictable, chaotic projects? We see other examples of that in science, where you have a complex system with a chaotic interplay of many sort of random events, where the overall results are highly predictable. Thermodynamics is the classical example. The path of a single molecule in the air is completely unpredictable. But the overall properties of the gas consisting of many chaotically interacting particles is very predictable to a high degree of precision according to the laws of thermodynamics. And technology evolution, like any evolutionary process, is inherently complex enough, consisting of enough chaotic interplay of unpredictable individual events, that the overall results have certain measurable properties that we can predict very precisely. And I'll show you many examples of that. We have hundreds of examples of this. We've built mathematical models of it. The price performance of computing has followed a smooth double exponential growth going back to the late 19th century. These are very highly predictable phenomena, and they're not derailed by little things like world wars or depressions or other events, these hurricanes. They are very smooth trends that go through all of this sort of unpredictable, chaotic human activity. But with these models, we can make reliable predictions about certain aspects. Basically, the power of information technologies is measured in price, performance, capacity, bandwidth, amount of data being moved around, amount of knowledge that human species has, the amount of knowledge we have about the brain, the amount of knowledge we have about biology. All of these things are highly predictable. And then we can build scenarios if we understand what computing will be like, what communications will be like, how much genetic data we'll have sequenced, all, you know, hundreds of different facts about these information technologies at different point in time. We can build scenarios about the future. And if anything, the future will be more remarkable than anything we can imagine today, because we're going to have all of you and all of your companies and millions of other people using their creativity to come up with surprising new applications to all of these very powerful capabilities. So that's one important observation, the fact that information technology is growing exponentially, and it goes far beyond Moore's Law. Moore's Law is actually just one paradigm of many within computing, and it's not just computing. It's many different types of fields of which information is a principal property that are growing exponentially. The other important observation is that information technology is becoming increasingly influential to where it will be basically the only thing of value when we get to the 2020s. It's already a significant portion, the information content of just about every product. I mean, even the chairs you're sitting in have an information content that they're designed on computer-assisted design stations. They're manufactured in just-in-time factories. Every product has an information component. Many industries now are basically comprised of information. CEOs basically deal with information no matter what kind of company you're dealing with. When we get to the 2020s, we'll be able to manufacture virtually any product from very inexpensive information-based computerized processes that will reassemble matter and energy in new ways. Information ultimately will encompass everything that is important. You put those two observations together, and you get a very remarkable vision of what the future world will be like. So I want to take you through this observation, show you how ubiquitous this exponential growth is, how influential information technology is. If, for example, we're understanding our biology, all of health and disease and medicine as information processes. We have these 23,000 software programs inside us. These are information programs. We're understanding how they work and actually getting the tools to reprogram them, and I'll come back to that observation. Probably the most important observation or insight in terms of acceleration that this activity has reveal is the fact that the paradigm shift rate, the rate of technical progress, the rate at which we change paradigms, is itself accelerating. It's getting faster. It used to be, hundreds of years ago, people didn't realize that there was change at all. Their grandparents lived the same lives they did. They fully expected their grandchildren to do the same. That pretty much was the case up until 1800, when suddenly those grandchildren had very different lives, and the lives, for example, of the weavers in England was turned on its head, and that whole business model was destroyed very quickly, led to the Luddite movement. So around the 19th century, certainly by the late 19th century, people realized that change was a constant. But change actually is not a constant. Change is accelerating. But it's remarkable to me how many otherwise thoughtful observers really don't take this insight into consideration. I was at, a couple years ago, this Future of Life conference. Time magazine organized on the 50th anniversary of the discovery of the structure of DNA, and all of our speakers were asked to comment on what the next 50 years will bring. Every single speaker there used the last 50 years as a model for the next 50 years. So even Jim Watson said, well, in 50 years we'll have drugs that enable you to eat as much as you want and remain slim. And I said, Jim, we've actually done that in mice, these FRCO, fat insulin receptor knockout experiments. Inhibited the fat insulin receptor gene, which basically says hold on to every calorie because the next hunting season may not work out so well. And these mice ate ravenously. They remained slim. They got the health benefits of being slim. They didn't get diabetes. They didn't get heart disease. They lived 20% longer. They got the benefits of caloric restriction without restriction. And there are five pharmaceutical companies rushing to bring this to the human market. We have a new technology now that can turn genes off, RNA interference, blocks the messenger RNA expressing a gene. And we'll have this in 5 to 10 years, not 50 years. Every speaker there, except for actually Bill Joy and myself, have this linear model of the future, applying today's pace of progress, today's tools. People working in brain reverse engineering just did the mental experiment. Okay, I'm working on this ion channel and this dendrite, and it's going to take me another 18 months. And there are five ion channels, 18 months times five, and then there's all these different types of dendrites, and it'll be 100 years before we reverse engineer the brain. Without realizing that we're doubling the spatial resolution, that is, we're cutting it in half every year of brain scanning, the amount of data on the brain is doubling every year. The computers we have to simulate these processes are doubling every year. The databases are doubling. The pace of progress is accelerating. So we will complete that project much sooner if you take into consideration this exponential growth. So if we look at some examples of that, in the 19th century, the telephone was introduced. That was the first virtual reality technology. You could actually be with someone else, even if you're hundreds of miles apart in these virtual spaces, at least as far as the auditory sense is concerned. It took 50 years to be adopted by a quarter of the U.S. population. We did the same thing with cell phones in about 8 years. If we look at different communication technologies, telephone, television, radio, all took decades to be adopted by a quarter of the population. The web, mobile phones, personal computers did that in a few years' time. All of these graphs are logarithmic graphs, meaning as you go up the graph, it represents multiplying, not adding to whatever is being measured, generally in powers of 10. On a logarithmic graph, a straight line represents exponential growth. You can see it's actually better than exponential growth. We are, right now, doubling the paradigm shift rate every decade. So therefore, the whole 20th century was not 100 years of progress at the year 2008, because we were speeding up to that rate. It was actually, according to my model, 20 years of progress at the year 2008. We'll make another 20 years of progress at the year 2008 in 14 years by 2014, and we'll do it again in 7 years. That's the explosive power of exponential growth. That'll continue. We'll make 20,000 years of progress at the year 2008 in the 21st century, about 1,000 times greater than in the 21st century, that's 1,000 times greater than the 20th century. The 20th century was no slouch to change. One gets a very different perspective if you take into consideration this inherent acceleration in technological progress. And it's basically a key feature of an evolutionary process. It's true of both biology and technology. You may not be able to read this precisely, but this is a double logarithmic graph. On the x-axis is how many years ago this event took place, basically in powers of 10. And then on the y-axis is how long it took for this particular paradigm to get established until the next paradigm shift. So the very first paradigm shift in the upper left-hand corner, basically the evolution of biology, took billions of years. It took billions of years for RNA and DNA. RNA actually came first to evolve. But at that point, evolution had a little computer system, an information backbone, to conduct its experiments. And an evolutionary process works through indirection. It takes time to create something, but then it uses that capability to evolve the next stage. So that's really the key reason that the next stage goes more quickly, and the products, the results of that next stage are exponentially more powerful. So the next stage, the Cambrian explosion, went a lot faster. It took 100 million years rather than over a billion years. So it was at least 10 times faster than the stage before it. Biological evolution then kept accelerating. Homo sapiens, the first species to combine a higher cognitive function with an opposable appendage, a thumb that could manipulate the environment, evolved in only a few hundred thousand years. And there's actually only a few genetic changes involving a few tens of thousands of bytes of information that distinguishes us from the primates that we evolved from. Three different genetic changes. One, we have a larger skull at the expense of a weaker jawbone. More of our brain matter is devoted to cortical function, so we have a larger cerebral cortex. And the pivot point of the thumb was moved up an inch. If you look at chimpanzee hands, the pivot point is an inch down. It looks like our hand, but they don't have a power grip. They don't have fine motor coordination. We really could manipulate the environment, convert our mental models of how the world could be into reality. So again, working through indirection, evolution used one of its creations, Homo sapiens, and brought in the next stage of evolution, terms of increases of complexity on this planet, which was technology. And the first stage took ten times less time than the evolution of Homo sapiens itself. It took some tens of thousands of years to evolve stone tools, the wheel, fire. That kept accelerating. We kept using the latest generation of technology to evolve the next stage. Half a millennium ago, the printing press took a century to be adopted. Half a century ago, the first computers were actually designed pen on paper, wired with screwdrivers. Now we use computers and advanced computer assisted design software to automatically do 12 layers of design. And so we see a continual acceleration. And we also, interestingly, see technology evolution emerging from biological evolution, kind of in a seamless straight line. A couple of objections came up to this chart that I've been showing for a couple of years. One said, well, first of all, the Cambrian explosion didn't take 100 million years. It took 50 million years. And the Internet, you've got to include the DARPANET, so it's not 8 years. It should be 15 years. You change the data, you still get a straight line because those kind of changes just don't show up on the resolution of this chart. I mean, the Internet didn't take a million years, and the Cambrian explosion didn't happen in 15 years. This is a very inexorable process. The other objection is, okay, could we'll just put points on this chart that happen to fit on the straight line. So to address that, I put 14 different lists that I picked really at random, and these are pretty well established lists: Carl Sagan's Cosmic Calendar, American Museum of Natural History, Encyclopedia Britannica, 14 different lists from key reference works and thinkers as to what they thought the key events were in either biological and or technological evolution. And you see some spreading of the points because people do disagree how long the Cambrian explosion took. They have different ideas of what the key events were. There's a big disagreement on when language first appeared. But you nonetheless see an inexorable straight line that's hard to miss. There is this inherent acceleration in an evolutionary process. And if we put all this on a linear graph, it looks like everything just happened. And this is a linear graph, and it shows an exponential trend and a linear trend. You can see early on it doesn't look like there's much difference. In fact, at any point on that exponential trend, if you take a small piece of it, it looks like a straight line. And this is why I call this the intuitive linear perspective. Intuitively, it just seems like there's a certain pace of progress people forget, the distant past, like 2 years ago, and they just assume that the current pace of progress will continue. Most government models are based on linear projections. That works actually fairly well for the 2 or 3 years that most government models actually use. One of the reasons the Social Security debate is interesting in that they use these linear models to project 2042. That's the date I have for the singularity, when non-biological intelligence will be billions of times more powerful than non-biological. So then biological intelligence will have radical life extension. Their models say we'll have an 11% increase in longevity, and extremely conservative estimates of change. I mean, there's a very radically different perspective that one gets if one has models that incorporate this exponential view. The ongoing exponential is actually made of a series of S-curves. People say, well, don't exponential trends run out of steam at some point? I mean, rabbits in Australia, they multiply exponentially, but then they hit the limits of their environment, foliage, and the exponential progression stops. When it comes to information technology, specific paradigms do run out of steam. Moore's law will run out of steam in about 15 years. Each particular paradigm runs out of steam at some point, but it creates research pressure to create the next paradigm. We've been predicting the end of Moore's law now for quite some time. The first predictions were 2002 until now for 2022. By the end of 15 years, the key features will be a few atoms in width. We won't be able to shrink transistors on an integrated circuit anymore. That will be the end of Moore's law. That will be the end of that paradigm. But it won't be the end of the exponential growth of computing. Moore's law was not the first, but the fifth paradigm to bring exponential growth to computing. These are 49 famous computers on a logarithmic graph that goes back to the 1890 census. Use these old data processing machines. Use these punch card devices, which are subsequently shipped to the Florida Election Commission. 1940s, Alan Turing built a computer out of old telephone relays, cracked the German Enigma code. It provided a dilemma to Churchill and Roosevelt, and that they couldn't use the information very readily without tipping off the enemy that they cracked the code. A lot of interesting literature about how they then went on to trick the enemy that they got the information in some other way. Vacuum tubes came in the 50s. CBS predicted the election of Eisenhower. They were then shrinking vacuum tubes, making them smaller and smaller to keep this exponential growth going. They hit a wall. They couldn't shrink the vacuum tubes anymore and keep the vacuum. Then a whole different paradigm came out of left field, transistors, which had a niche application radio. They're not small tubes. It's a different paradigm. Kept the exponential growth going. That's the fourth stripe. Finally, integrated circuits came in. And the sixth paradigm, when this runs out of steam, will be three-dimensional molecular computing. We live in a three-dimensional world. We might as well use the third dimension. Our brain's organized in three dimensions. And even though it uses a very cumbersome and slow information processing method, basically chemical switching, which moves at a few hundred feet per second, a million times slower than electronics, it gets its power from being organized in three dimensions. And you'll notice that that's actually not a straight line. That's another exponential. You have exponential growth and the rate of exponential growth. It took 3 years to double the price performance of computing in 1900, 2 years in the middle of the century, but now doubling it every 1 year. There's a theoretical reason for that. As the technology gets more cost-effective, you put more money into research, and so the rate of progress accelerates. The computer industry, such as it was with a handful of government war-related projects and academic projects in 1950, it's a trillion-dollar industry today. We have this smooth double exponential growth going for over a century. Personal experience, when I came to MIT in the 1960s, computer actually about the size of this room, a quarter of a MIP, 32,000 words of memory, 144,000 bytes, much less powerful than the computer in your cell phone, cost $11 million. There's been exponential growth. It's actually used vacuum tubes. There's obviously many examples of this. This is another chart from Hans Moravec, shows the same thing. These are different computers. I won't dwell on these charts. Interesting thing about the progression in supercomputers is that we're now approaching the computational requirement to emulate human intelligence. In the book, I have four different derivations from different techniques and from different thinkers, including myself, as to what is the computational requirement to emulate human intelligence. You get figures between 10 to the 14th and 10 to the 16th calculations per second. Interestingly, there's been several developments since the book went to press that only show that we're actually moving faster than I projected, because I have here 2013. We achieved 10 to the 16th, which is the figure that I've used, 10 quadrillion calculations per second. But just 2 weeks ago, Japan announced two different projects to do 10 quadrillion CPS by 2010. But anyway, we have very smooth exponential growth. It's been going on since supercomputers started. And many different examples. Dynamic RAM has gone through different technologies. Now look how smooth this curve is. I mean, 1968 you could buy one transistor for a dollar. 2002 you could buy 10 million. It's now approaching 100 million. When I was a high school student in New York, I used to hang out at the Plus Electronics shop in Canal Street, which is still there. And I'd buy something about this big, which was a telephone relay with support circuitry, equivalent to one transistor, but much slower. Cost about $40. So now for a dollar, you can buy 100 million very fast transistors. And look how smooth this progression is. This is not, it looks like the result of some tabletop experiment. It's not coming out of one company. This is the result of the interplay of millions of people, customers and engineers and marketing people and hundreds of companies and dozens of countries and accusations of one country dumping products on another. And out of all of this chaotic interplay comes this very smooth progression going back almost half a century. As we've made the transistors faster, they're smaller. As we make them cheaper, they're smaller, they're faster. It's improved exponential growth in the speed. You combine those two factors, the cost per transistor cycle has been coming down by half every 1.1 year. If you add all the other innovations in electronic design, data caching, pipelining, you get a doubling of price performance every year. So that's, in economic terms, a deflationary factor of 50%. And it turns out anything having to do with information, we see the same 50% roughly, depends exactly what you're measuring, sometimes it's 40, sometimes it's 60, but roughly 50% deflation factor. And depending on which week it is, the economists are worrying about inflation or deflation. They'll say deflation is bad because, yes, on the face of it, it's a good thing. You can get the same stuff for half the money. But people aren't going to actually double their consumption in 1 year and keep up with that. So the economy, to the extent that it's information technology and that percentage is increasing and will be the majority of the economy in the 2020s, will shrink. But actually what we've seen is there's been exponential growth in the consumption of every kind of information technology that more than keeps up with this doubling. We've had 18% compounded growth in information technology for the last 50 years in constant dollars. So we more than double our consumption. People didn't buy iPods for $10,000 10 years ago. I mean, every time the price performance reaches a certain capacity, new applications open up. I put this chart up here just to show you a random other example. This is not shrinking transistors on an integrated circuit, which is Moore's law. This is shrinking magnetic spots on a magnetic substrate. Different engineers, different companies, same exponential progression. And we see this really in anything that has to do with information. And a very revolutionary aspect of that is the biotechnology revolution. This is completely different than the old way in which we used to develop drugs, which accounts for 99% of the drugs on the market today. The old method was called drug discovery, very similar to tool discovery, when primitive man and woman would just find things. Oh, here's a stone. This might make a good hammer. We didn't have the means of shaping those tools, so we would find something. Oh, here's something that lowers blood pressure. We have no model or theory as to why it works. Invariably, it was a very crude tool. It had lots of side effects, many of which were discovered later. There's been a lot of news about that in the press recently. And people have a view that, well, prescription drugs you should avoid because they're generally quite harsh. That's true of these discovered drugs, which comprise most of the drugs on the market today. But the new paradigm of development is called rational drug design, to actually understand the information processes underlying biology. And biology is a set of information processes. I mentioned this one gene, the fat insulin receptor gene. If you shut that down in the fat cells, these fat cells will accumulate a little bit of fat, but then otherwise will not just keep accumulating fat. It was a good program. It was a good algorithm 30,000 years ago to hold on to every calorie, because calories are few and far between. How much sulfur do you have that you haven't changed in 30 months, let alone 30,000 years? There's a lot of genes we'd like to turn off. We have now, just in the last 2 years, a new methodology, RNA interference, where we send in little reverse pieces of RNA that latch onto the messenger RNA expressing a gene and destroy it. And it's very effective at turning genes off. So every major disease, we've identified key genes that are required for that disease to progress. Atherosclerosis, the cause of heart disease, cancer, type 2 diabetes. There are hundreds of drugs in the development, and some now entering the testing pipeline, that use RNA interference to turn off key disease-promoting, and in some cases even aging-promoting, genes. There are new techniques for gene therapy to actually turn genes on or add new genes. The old problem was in sending them in through viral vectors, they would end up in the wrong chromosome in the wrong place. One interesting technique, which has actually been working and has cured disease in animals and now been approved for human testing, is to take a cell from the patient, modify it in vitro, inspect it, make sure the information got inserted in the right place. When you've verified that, then you multiply it by 40 million, re-inject it into the patient. It works its way into the right tissues. This has cured pulmonary hypertension in animals. It's going into human trials. There are many other techniques that are showing promise for gene therapy. So we'll have not just designer babies, but designer baby boomers. But we're learning to reprogram the whole information processes underlying disease. In a book that I came out with last year, Fantastic Voyage Was Long Enough to Live Forever, that I co-authored with Terry Grossman, MD, we talked about the seven stages of atherosclerosis and what the information processes are underlying each one of those stages. and many of them have key vulnerabilities that we can reprogram. We have very effective drugs that can turn enzymes off. So in stage 4 of atherosclerosis, there's a particular enzyme that at that stage destroys HDL, the good cholesterol. If you inhibit that enzyme, that stage is undercut. The phase 2 trial showed it stopped atherosclerosis, which is very dramatic. I personally wouldn't hang my hat on any one of these developments, but Pfizer is hanging its hat on this particular drug, torsatropine. They're investing $1 billion on the phase 3 trials, which is a record. But there are thousands of these developments in the pipeline where we are understanding precisely the information processes underlying disease, aging, and biology in general, and gaining the tools to reprogram it in very precise ways, which will have far fewer side effects than the old-fashioned discovered drugs. And here we see the same very dramatic exponential growth. The general project was not a mainstream project when it was first announced in 1990. They announced a 15-year project to sequence the genome. Mainstream skeptics said, we just succeeded in 1989 in sequencing 1/10,000th of the genome. How are you going to finish this in 15 years? And 10 years later, the skeptics were still going strong, saying, see, I told you this wasn't going to work. Here we are 10 years to a 15-year project, and you finished 2% of the project. But it's the last 7 doublings that go from 1% to 100%, and the project was done on time. We've gone from $12 per base pair to 2 cents in 2004. It's now approaching a penny. The amount of genetic data has doubled every year. This is a logarithmic graph. This represents smooth exponential growth, doubling every year. This continued after 2003. We're now sequencing all the different disease states. We're sequencing other species. We're sequencing the sequence of information processes that underlie disease. Very smooth exponential growth. We see this in the effective cost of drugs, which are information processes. AIDS drugs first cost $30,000 per patient per year. Didn't work very well. They're now down in 4 countries, like Sub-Saharan Africa, to $100 per patient per year. Still expensive, but it's actually now affordable for foundations and government agencies and NGOs to step in and actually do something about that problem. We see this in every aspect of information underlying biology. Communications, which is the subject of this conference, something that George has talked about for many years. Gilder's law directly postulates a exponential growth in communications. We have many charts on this, as does George, showing every aspect of communication technology, wired, wireless, bandwidth, number of bits being moved around, size of the Internet. Doubling depends on exactly what you're measuring. It might be 14 months, 11 months. 12 months is typical. These are just a few examples, Internet data traffic, the backbone of the Internet. This is the chart I mentioned earlier that I was looking at, just a small piece of it in the mid-1980s, doubling. Every year, the number of nodes on the Internet. Doubling every year means multiplying by 1,000 in 10 years, 1,000,000 in 20 years, 1,000,000,000 in 30 years. Because of that second level of exponential growth, where we're increasing slowly the exponential rate of expansion, it's actually 25 years to multiply by 1,000,000,000. And information technology is already deeply influential. It's 8% of the economy measured narrowly, deeply influential on the rest of the economy. So imagine multiplying the impact of that by a factor of 1,000,000,000. This is the same data. This is a linear graph. Every other graph I've shown you has been logarithmic. So, and we live in a linear world. This is how we experience technology. So it looked like the Internet just came out of nowhere in the mid-1990s. But if you looked at this exponential trend on a logarithmic graph, you could see it coming. Another exponential trend is miniaturization. Electronics obviously has been miniaturized, but it's also true of mechanical systems. State-of-the-art is microelectronic mechanical systems that are not quite nanotechnology yet, but we're shrinking the size of electronic and mechanical technology by a factor of about 5. The linear dimension per decade, which is a factor of over 100 in three-dimensional volume. These are some illustrations from Eric Drexler's 1986 book. Which have been simulated, and there actually now are interesting experiments showing that we can actually manipulate matter and energy at the molecular level. There are very interesting devices being built really out of molecular fragments. One scientist built a little robot that actually walks with an amusing human-like gait, but built at the molecular level. A lot of interesting experiments now being developed. And there are also experiments already showing therapeutic and diagnostic functions, some of which are quite impressive, of putting blood cell-sized devices that are nano-engineered in the bloodstream of animals. So, okay, these don't have computers and communication devices in them yet. So I wouldn't call them nanobots, but they are blood cell-sized capsules that are nano-engineered. One scientist actually cured type 1 diabetes with a very clever little device. You put hundreds of thousands of these in the bloodstream of animals, and it actually cures type 1 diabetes. It lets that insulin out in a controlled fashion. It blocks antibodies because type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune disease. And it actually works. There's now actually a version of that that's being developed for human trials. But the idea of blood cell-sized devices is not as futuristic as it may seem. And this is an animation of one designed by Rob Friedis of a blood cell-sized device that is basically a robotic red blood cell. Red blood cells is an aspect of biology we have reverse engineered. We understand how red blood cells work. They're actually not that complicated. And it does illustrate a key issue with biology, which is although biology is very intricate, it is suboptimal because an evolutionary process will make certain assumptions, and then it has to build on those assumptions. So, for example, all of biology is built on proteins, and proteins are a limited class of material that you can fold up from a linear sequence of amino acids. It has interesting properties, and it's certainly very diverse, but it's limited. Our thinking takes place in the internal connections that I mentioned at chemical switching speeds, which are a million times slower than electronics. They're calculated by 200 transactions per second. Again, a million times slower than electronics. Conservative analysis of these RESPR sites show that if you replace 10% of your red blood cells with the robotic version, you could do an Olympic sprint for 15 minutes without taking a breath and sit at the bottom of your pool for 4 hours. Another device that Rob Friedis has designed in quite some detail is a robotic white blood cell. This will require computers and communication because these are intelligent devices. I actually watched my own white blood cell in a microscope, and it was an intelligent cell. It could actually detect this other bacterium on another part of the slide. It executed a very clever maneuver to block it and destroy it. But it was very slow. It took an hour and a half for it to do this. It was a very boring thing to watch. And these devices could do that in seconds. They could download software from the internet to combat specific pathogens. If that sounds futuristic, I point out not only are we putting blood cell-sized devices in the bloodstream of animals. We also have devices inside our body that we are now downloading software from outside the patient. For example, there's a whole range of neural implants that are put in the, these are FDA-approved devices, for example, a device for Parkinson's disease that actually replaces the biological neurons that were destroyed by that disease. And the neurons that are in the vicinity of this device receive signals now from this computer. Whereas they used to get signals from the biological neurons that used to be there, they're perfectly happy. You get signals from a computer, you now have a hybrid of biological and non-biological intelligence working quite well. And the latest generation of this device allows you to actually download new software from your neural implant from outside the patient. So these are not introduced through the bloodstream yet. They're not nanobots. But we do have different early harbingers of these trends. If you go out, say, 25 years, when these communication and computation technologies are a billion times more powerful than they are today, it's a very conservative conclusion that these blood cell-sized capsules, which we are experimenting with today, will have reasonably capable computers and communication devices. Those computers will be able to harness their computational capacity on a local area network. They'll be able to perform intelligent functions. We come back to our exponential growth of computing. There's the 20th century on the left-hand side, projecting through the 21st century. We'll achieve the 10 to the 15th calculations per second, which I derive in the book as being sufficient to the hardware side of computation needed to emulate human intelligence by actually a few years from now. $1,000 of computation will achieve that level in about 2020. And this was a controversial notion at the 1998 Telecosm when the Age of Social Machines came out. It was not a mainstream view. I would say there's been a sea change in attitudes towards this. Knowledgeable observers say, yes, there's no question we'll have plenty of hardware capacity to emulate human intelligence. In fact, the published ITRS roadmap from the semiconductor industry shows this. So does Intel's announced roadmap. It goes out to 2018, and you have $1,000 of computation approaching the amount needed to emulate the human brain. This is pretty much a mainstream view today, as is the expectation that we can build electronics in three dimensions. We've already, there again, we've had very dramatic experiments showing the feasibility of that proof of concept in the last 7 years since my last book came out. So now the key controversy or issue or question is, will we have the software? Will we have the algorithms of human intelligence? Or will we just have very fast calculators? And that's where the significance of this project comes in, which is we have examples of human intelligence, and it's not hidden from us. And here again, we see exponential growth in our capacity to understand the human brain, the amount of information we have about the brain, the tools we have to perform this project. There's exponential growth in the spatial and temporal resolution of brain scanning. The amount of data we have is growing exponentially. But then the question comes up, all right, we're getting this data with a new scanning technology from the University of Pennsylvania that can actually, for the first time, see individual interneuronal connections in vivo in the living brain and see them signaling in real time. That wasn't true up until maybe 18 months ago. I mean, prior to that, we weren't, I mean, I'm in the AI field. My field is pattern recognition, which is the bulk of human intelligence. And we weren't getting a lot of information from brain science. Because imagine I asked you to reverse engineer a computer and I gave you crude magnetic sensors you could put outside the box. You'd develop a crude theory, but you really wouldn't get to the key underlying principles of operation. That was pretty much the state of the art 3-4 years ago in brain scanning. But now we can actually see a living brain and see the individual connections and see them signaling in real time. But then the question comes up, all right, we can get this data, but can we make heads or tails of it? I mean, can we understand it? Doug Hofstadter has said for many years, well, probably our intelligence is below that threshold needed to understand our intelligence. And maybe this is just an inherent property that a system has a certain complexity and it's not complex enough to understand its own complexity. And if we were smarter and therefore able to understand the human brain, well, then necessarily our brains would be that much more complicated and we'd never catch up with it. But what we're finding is that that's not the case. The brain is not one big neural net. It's hundreds of different regions. We've actually already had detailed models expressed in precise mathematical terms and simulations in about 2 dozen regions of the brain. This is 15 regions of the auditory cortex which have been reverse engineered, modeled in mathematics, simulated, and a sophisticated psychoacoustic test applied to the simulation. We get very similar results applying the psychoacoustic test for human auditory perception. Doesn't prove it's a perfect model, but it is actually quite accurate. There's a very exciting model, the cerebellum, which comprises more than half the neurons of the brain, where we do our skill formation. And again, this simulation, applying tests to it, gets very similar results to human skill formation. And it brings up another interesting issue, which is how complicated is the brain? Well, it's not a simple system. If you take the brain itself, it's thousands of trillions of bytes of information. That's a lot of complexity. But the design is much less complex. The design is contained in the genome. If you say, wait a second, you've got to include the genetic machinery, like the ribosomes. I'd add that in. It actually adds very little complexity. The genome is 3 billion rung, 6 billion bits. It's 800 million bytes. But, well, 2% of that codes for proteins. The other 98% used to be called junk. We now understand it's actually needed for gene expression. So all of it is needed. It's replete with redundancies. One sequence called ALU is repeated 300,000 times. If you apply standard data compression to that 800 million bytes, you get about 30 to 50 million bytes. In the book, I generously say 30 to 100 million bytes, but that's less than Microsoft Word. And it's a billion times less than the complexity we actually see in the brain. So how could that be? How could something with a 30 to 50 million byte complexity create something that's a billion times more complicated than itself? We see that all the time in computer design. I routinely use genetic algorithms where we have a genetic algorithm with a certain complexity. a certain complexity of a starting solution. It then creates millions of copies of itself, interacts with the complex environment, and actually simulates evolution with sexual reproduction, and actually evolves something much more complex than the original design. And this is actually how the genetic information actually wires the brain. There's actually only a few genes comprising a few tens of thousands of bytes of information that describes the wiring of the cerebellum. It says there's four different neuron types. They're wired like this. Now repeat 10 billion times and add some randomness with each repetition. And then this largely, stochastically, randomly wired system interacts with a complex environment. Child learns to walk, to talk, to catch a fly ball, and it gets filled up with meaningful information. And this is all driving economic growth. So I'll just show you one interesting chart. E-commerce has grown smoothly, exponentially. Not only has the power of the Internet grown in terms of technology, but the actual adoption has been smooth exponential growth. Now, you might say, well, wait a second. Wasn't there a boom and a bust in there somewhere? Well, that was just a capital markets phenomenon. We see this kind of boom-bust psychology as a harbinger of true revolutions. We saw it in the 19th century. We saw it in AI. We certainly saw it in telecommunications. Wall Street, the investment community, looks at this phenomenon and says, oh, the Internet's going to change every business model and the value of store. Then 18 months later, when every business model hasn't been turned on its head overnight, no, I guess I was wrong, and the values go the other way. But the actual adoption is smooth exponential growth. And let me, how are we doing on time? Yeah. So let me just sum up with some scenarios. If we just use a little bit of scenario building with these capabilities, by early in the next decade, 2010 and 2012, computers won't be just rectangular objects to carry around. They will disappear into the environment. They'll be embedded in our clothing, and they'll be quite powerful. We'll be interacting with virtual personalities. I was at Google last week. They've actually created intelligent language translation systems that are entirely data-driven that match human levels of translation. So we will have effective language technologies. Images will be written directly to our retinas from our eyeglasses and contact lenses. I'm on the Army Science Advisory Board, and the Army is using these quite extensively. They're expensive today, but they'll be quite ubiquitous over the next decade, so we can all be in virtual reality environments and interact with virtual personalities that overlay the real world. If we got to 2029, it's really where things get interesting. We realize that 25 turns of the screw in terms of doubling price performance is actually 30 turns of the screw. It's a billion factor increase in the power of these technologies. We'll have reverse engineered the human brain. We'll have non-biological systems that then combine the strength of human intelligence, which is our pattern recognition, with ways in which computers are already more powerful than we are. They can share their knowledge instantly. We spent years training one set of research computers to understand human speech. If you want your computer to do that, you don't have to go through those years of training like we do have to do with every child. You can just load the evolved patterns of one computer that learns its lessons. It's called loading the software. Machines can share their knowledge at electronic speed, a million times faster than human language. They can do these things much more powerfully and quickly. Most importantly, they're doubling in power every year. Our biological intelligence is 6. We have 10 of the 26 power calculations per second among the whole human species. That'll still be 10 of the 26 50 years from now. Non-biological intelligence will cross over in the 2020s and going to predominate in the 2030s. But this is not an alien invasion of intelligent machines. It's emerging from within our civilization. We're already doing many intellectual feats that would be impossible without our computers. And if all these sort of narrow artificial intelligence programs were to stop today, our economic infrastructure would grind to a halt. That wasn't true 25 years ago. And we're getting more and more intimate with our technology. It ultimately will be immersed in our bodies and brains. Intelligent nanobots, we'll have billions of them, will keep us healthy from within. They'll go inside our brain and provide brain extensions from within our brain to an intimate collaboration of our biological neurons with these non-biological forms of intelligence. It'll provide full immersion virtual reality from within the nervous system. But most importantly, it will vastly expand human intelligence. And I do consider this to be human intelligence. We are the species that seeks to go beyond our limitations. We didn't stay on the planet. We didn't stay on the ground. We didn't stay with the limitations of our biology. We're constantly expanding our horizons. We're changing who we are. We're going to expand our horizons through this intimate merger with the technology we're creating. And one of the benefits is every time there's a technological advance, we advance our life expectancy. It was not much more than low 20s thousands of years ago. It was not in the interest of the species for us to live past child-rearing, and that generally meant like 26 years old. Human life expectancy was 37 in 1800. Human life, as described by Hobbes, was extremely hard then. Then we had sanitation and antibiotics. It's more than doubled. We'll see huge strides through biotechnology as we master the information processes underlying biology. And with nanotechnology and strong artificial intelligence, we'll go beyond the limitations of biology. So if you can stay healthy the old-fashioned way for another decade or so, we may get to actually see the remarkable century ahead. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ray. Wow. This is a terrific vision. But I'd like to be a devil's advocate or whatever in this. The computer power now has reached the level of an insect, right? I mean, you had 2000, year 2000, we were rapidly approaching insect level. Why can't computers even begin to repeat insect performance? It's my book, The Silicon Eye, tells about the capacities of the neural system of a fly. And we can't even begin to duplicate that functionality on microwatts, which the fly uses. It seems that there's fundamental principles that are different. It's not just change in quantity, it's a fundamental understanding of how these neurological phenomena function.
Well, actually, there are insect-like robots that have insect-like qualities, but largely that's not been the focus of our artificial intelligence. We have hundreds of examples of computers operating at human levels for complex tasks that used to require human intelligence, and they don't yet have the full range of human intelligence, obviously. They're not attaining test levels. That won't happen to the late 2020s. But we have very sophisticated programs that can diagnose your electrocardiogram and blood cell images and flying lamps, airplanes, and detect credit card fraud and make about $1 trillion of investments in the stock market that are controlled by intelligent programs. And these were considered very speculative AI research projects just 15 years ago. And I would say they are comparable intelligence. But they're highly focused on commercially interesting tasks. But there are different methods of organization. The human brain, and I skipped over these slides, is massively parallel. It's self-organizing. It's sort of a chaotic system itself. Uses evolutionary principles in its own thinking. And this is sort of the type of paradigm we use in pattern recognition. Which is still not at human levels, but, again, has advantages over machine intelligence because we can, if we have, one of the projects I'm working on is finding subtle patterns in the stock market. We have a system that is doing very well, and it can then apply these pattern recognition principles to 5,000 stocks and track them every second. Which is something we'll be
doing. Do you accept that there are fundamentally different principles that govern the nervous system of a fly, of looting the slaughter, harvesting subtle chemicals from the air, performing the acrobatics that it can perform? That's in using microwatts of power. I mean, this seems to be a fundamental different thing. Recently, you know about the Grand Challenge that DARPA set up, where all these major teams got together to try to create a vehicle that could cross the Mojave Desert. And,
well, actually,
and it was a comedy of errors when they attempted it. I mean, there seemed to be...
Actually, the device, not during that contest, but actually did succeed in going across the entire country without any human intervention. There was a human there that could take over necessary, but this was on actual roads with other human drivers.
What was that? Who did that? Was it Carnegie Mellon University?
And I think you'll see, I mean, they're going to run this every year, and I think you'll see significant progress with that project. There are different principles of operation between most software, but actually we do use self-organizing techniques and highly parallel techniques in pattern recognition, which is my own field. And we're beginning to get actually human levels for specific tasks within pattern recognition. And the great trend, I think, in building computer hardware and software will be to emulate these principles, which I went over very quickly, which you're alluding to. Intel has admitted it's gone too far in building very fast single processors, which kind of pushes the barrier. If you want to overcome the thermal issue, you need to build a large number of parallel processors that are not that powerful. The human brain has 100 trillion processors. It's only 200 calculations per second, and therefore generates very little heat. I talked extensively about heat in the book. We'll ultimately be able to use reversible computing, which cuts the heat consumption by a factor of a billion. Intel just announced last week a major breakthrough, cutting the heat consumption by several hundred. These are what you're alluding to. Actually, are grand trends to be towards biomimicry, of really understanding how biology works and applying those principles. There's nothing in those principles that we can't apply to our technology, and that is the direction that these intelligent systems are going towards.
But let's say that you could use a brain scan on a computer, so that you could identify every atom in the computer, every molecule, and locate it and follow its trajectory, you still wouldn't have any understanding of what that computer was doing without mastery of the source code of the software program that was being executed.
You have to model these things at the right level. If you ask an electrical engineer to reverse engineer a computer, they would say, okay, I need to track the specific signals, and that's routinely what electrical engineers do when they reverse engineer a product, and they could very readily, they could put sensors on individual signals and track them at sufficient speed, and they do this all the time, develop a very detailed principles of operation of how the computer hardware works, and then it could access the software, and people routinely access software and disassemble it and reverse engineer that. People do that with software all the time. So we are actually able to reverse engineer hardware and software, and we're doing that now with the brain. We are getting now the data, and we're showing we can actually understand how in a particular region of the brain the information is encoded, what the transformations are. You have to model it at a sort of salient level, and we find that you don't have to understand every atom. Chemistry has its own rules. In theory, you don't need chemistry to model everything in terms of physics, but it's hopelessly complex. Biology has its own rules. You have to model things at the correct level. We're finding out in certain types of neurons it's the location of the ions that are important. In other neurons, it's the concentration of certain neurotransmitters. And we're learning how the information is encoded and modeling the salient issues. And very often a system at a higher level is less complex than at a lower level. One neuron may be more complex than the actual information processing in a region of neurons. If you try to model one pancreatic islet cell, it's very, very complex. There are models of that. If you try to model the whole pancreas, it's actually simpler. And there are artificial pancreas examples in development.
How about any questions from the audience? You give your name.
Thank you.
Could you give your name?
Oh, Richard Vigilante. But watching the about rational drug development for a while. I don't know that we actually yet have a rationally developed drug. It's the one area where performance seems to have consistently fallen short of promise, where in communications and computers, we've consistently overperformed. Is it just on the cusp? Is there a reason for the underperformance? Or am I just wrong and we actually are performing up to expectations?
Well, you have to measure exactly where we are and that we aren't making exponential growth. People said, the Internet's supposed to be a big deal, and we're going to make all this money in Internet advertising. But Internet advertising is a big bust. Nobody can make money in Internet advertising. I mean, how long ago did people say that? 36 months ago? And now we have at least one company with a $100 billion market cap. 99% of its revenue is from Internet advertising. Most of the drugs in the pipeline now are based on rational drug design. I mentioned this corticotropin, which has the promise to dramatically undercut atherosclerosis, the cause of 90% of all heart disease. And there are thousands of developments, either in the development or testing pipeline. We do have this little matter of the FDA, the whole complex issue. In the software world, we have no certification of practitioners, and we have no certification of software products, and it's arguably the most productive industry in human history. We do have the FDA slowing things down, and how to deal with that is a complicated discussion. But it is happening. It's only recently. I mean, the general project only got completed a couple years ago, and that was just sort of the object code. We're still in the early stages of disassembling and reverse engineering to get them to understand what that data means. And we're making really dramatic progress, but it's still early. We are early in this biotechnology revolution. By my estimate, we're 10 or 15 years away from the sort of full maturity of that technology. And we typically have this boom-bust psychology. When there's the early harbingers of these revolutions, the Internet, telecommunications, AI, people go, wow, this is going to change everything. And then a few years later, when it happens, they say, I guess this whole thing didn't work. But I would say we will see in 5 to 10 years drugs that are being tested that really overcome heart disease and cancer, and that's probably fairly conservative because there's some now that would really have the promise of dramatically getting those major diseases under control. But we really, I believe, we'll have reverse engineered biology within 10 or 15 years.
My name is Wayne Thomas. I worry a lot about the economy, all the information that was transferred overseas, all the jobs. Who's going to make the money off of this in the next 15 or 20 years, and is it going to be the future of America, or is everybody going to be getting a bigger piece of it?
I do have some graphs of some relevance to your comments that I didn't show, that show exponential progression, just like all my other graphs, of engineers graduating in China, India, Korea, Japan, PhDs in engineering, computer science, all the natural sciences in these Asian countries and India, all following these kinds of graphs. So we were significantly ahead of China 20 years ago. We were graduating 60,000 engineers a year. That's dribbled down now to 53,000 and is up to 300,000 and growing. So that might cause some concern. But on the other hand, first of all, it doesn't trouble me that China and India are engaging the world in this kind of economic fashion, and that Chinese engineer is creating value for himself or herself and China and the United States. It's not a zero-sum game. It really is one integrated world economy. These old paradigms of national boundaries don't disappear instantly. Old paradigms don't go away. People are still pushing miles in many countries, but these new paradigms do establish themselves, and we have a vibrant world economy where products of great value bounce around the Internet and off satellites, really transcending these old boundaries. They're not taking value away from us, but I do think there's an issue of attracting more of our kids into science and engineering. But another issue is, I speak at many different conferences. I was music conference and a library, American Library Association. And those all sounded and read like computer conferences. National Association of Music Merchants, it was all computerized devices and very sophisticated computerized talk. And when I talked 8 years ago at the American Library Association, I said, you know, in 8 years you're going to be talking about, we'll be talking about books and card catalogs, we'll be talking about databases and searches, how it can means of accessing knowledge and automatic translation. Of course, that was kind of unrealistic, but that is, in fact, if you look at the catalog this year, that's exactly what the conference is about. So our young people are actually becoming very technologically sophisticated in every field.
Peter Treadway. Well, maybe this is sort of a follow-up. The law of accelerating returns. Talked about extensively in the previous book, the acceleration of paradigm shifts or new paradigm shift adoption. What does that imply for corporate profits and ROE and to get more mundane the stock market itself?
Well,
they go up or down?
They will go up. I mean, there's exponential expansion in our economy. We're creating more and more value. More of that value is not materially based, it's information processes. When we get full-scale, nano-based molecular manufacturing 20 to 25 years from now, even physical products will largely be information. I'll talk about energy, how we can capture 0.03% of the sunlight that falls on the Earth. We could meet our energy needs projected for 2030. We could do that with nano-engineered solar panels. A long discussion, but the economy will grow because the power of these information technologies grows. And as I showed you, even with the 50% deflation, we more than keep up with it. We have 18% growth in information technology. When that is not 8% of the economy, but 80% of the economy growth rate will be greater. So there'll be more profits. I mean, Google is a good example. I mean, that was a little company started. The dorm down the hall from my son, who also started an internet company, and I like to say he started a successful, still successful today, internet company at Stanford, not that other one. That's the nature of free enterprise. I mean, there's going to be continual overturning of business models. It's not just one new business model to make way for the internet. It's going to be constantly redefining business models, but we're constantly finding new valuable ways to apply information. This whole biology now is opening up a whole new world of applications, but there'll be many different types of applications as we encompass all of our knowledge, which is actually growing exponentially also, to new ways of making money. The corporate profits are up and will continue to grow, and we'll actually get that 18% per year in constant dollar growth rate of information technology to encompass more of the economy as information encompasses more of the economy.
Who has the microphone? Okay. Where'd you get it? All your applications are extremely interesting in the technological sense. Can you apply them in a sociological mean? In other words, when will war end? Or how can we find Osama bin Laden?
Well, finding Osama bin Laden would be easier. I mean, ultimately, the nanobots could be, it would be very hard to hide in the future world, at least with your biological body. But the technology is actually moving closer to us. I mean, the first machines, when I was at MIT and the computer took up the size of a room like this, they were very remote. You had to be sophisticated to use them, and they were tended by white-coated technicians. Then we had the personal computing revolution. Now they're in our pockets. They'll make their way in our clothing. I have one project that I'm working on to develop smart underwear that tracks your body. It'll be expensive and back of your health. They'll make their ways into our bodies and brains. And they're also becoming friendlier. You can call up the virtual receptionist at British Airways and talk to her about anything as long as it has to do with making reservations on British Airways. But language technologies are coming. Early in the next decade, we'll routinely be talking things over. Search engines won't wait to be asked. They'll actually have command of natural language. If you're struggling with some information, they will actually jump in and help you out. Like always available assistant will be online all the time. The technology meets basic human needs. I mean, cell phones are very complex. They use AI programs and routing information around, but you don't have to understand that. It's actually meeting a human need of communication. The Internet is creating new communities that are not, we're not limited now to geographic communities if you have a special interest or say you have a disease. People form communities around a chronic disease or any kind of interest level, and it's very democratizing. People walk into the doctor's offices with a lot of knowledge now. And the whole trend towards democracy in the world, I think, has been fueled by this decentralized communication. In the age of intelligent machines, I said that the Soviet Union would ultimately fall apart through the strength of this decentralized electronic communication. That is what we saw. It wasn't Yeltsin bravely standing on a tank in the 1991 coup against Gorbachev. It was this decentralized clandestine network of fax machines, mainly email on teletype machines. I had lunch with Gorbachev a couple months ago, and he fully agreed with that. Some of the things that put Yeltsin down, he would never agree with. So.
Dan Kruger, question I have is about human behavior in all this. As I see the rate of change accelerating. I see more and more people furious motion trying to stay ahead of being bewildered. I build shared virtual workspaces for a living. People connect and work all around the world in their authority, roles, the nature of relationships, all of that stuff. Day in, day out, ordinary living is very challenged by all this. How do you see that playing out?
I do think these technologies support human values. I mean, if you go back 200-300 years, you get a Hobbesian view of human life, which was extremely harsh, disaster-prone, poverty-filled, illness-filled. Even 50 years ago, very few people had jobs that actually were fulfilling. We can now engage the world in an intellectually satisfying way. One of the sort of benefits of reverse engineering the human brain will be greater insight, more precise insight as to how the human brain works, including human dysfunction, including our emotional intelligence, and including the weaknesses of our emotions. And obviously I'm aware of we have to approach that carefully, but we will have greater insight into ourselves rather than sort of these vague psychological models that we have today, and greater means of trying to overcome the limitations of human society. But fundamentally, I believe these technologies already are highly democratizing.
Hi, my name's Nick Trudenick. I wanted to ask about the law of accelerating returns. I can believe that improvements are accelerating and that it's an exponential curve, but in your appendix, you derive an equation that makes it look like an exponential to an exponential. So W equals E to the E to the T. And if I plug 1 in there, I get 15, and 2, it's 1,600, at 3, it's 500 million. And beyond that, it's like more particles than there are in the universe.
Well, the second level of exponential growth is actually very slow. We're doubling price performance of computing now every year, but that was 3 years, 100 years ago. So that second level is not that fast. But it does bring up the issue, aren't there overall limits to all of this? I mean, okay, each paradigm has a limit, then you go on to the next paradigm, but isn't there a limit to the overall capacity of matter and energy in terms of atoms to support computing processes? And there are limits, but they're not very limiting. I drive that. The book. Just circuitry that we've actually built, like nanotube circuitry, a 1-inch cube of nanotube circuitry would be 100 million times more powerful than the 10 to the 16 CPS of the human brain. And that's not even the ultimate capacity. The ultimate capacity is quite vast. And I talk about that in Chapter 3. Those limits won't really limit us. Those formulas are very sensitive. I had a whole dialogue with Hans Moravec, which I talk about in that appendix, and if you just slightly change that second exponent, in a fairly subtle way, it not only becomes very large, it actually blows up into infinity. And I don't believe that's the case. But we talk about exactly where the formulas break down. But it is clearly a double exponential. The data fits that, with the second exponent being fairly slow.
I guess mine is Ashby Foote. What about the dilemma of industries that are expanding exponentially but are regulated by government regulators that are only advancing, hopefully, at a linear scale?
Did you give your name, Ashby? Did you give your name?
Ashby Foote. Ashby Foote.
It's an issue. For example, FDA regulation, there are new technological approaches emerging that will be able to sort of approach that challenge more efficiently. Our ability to do biological simulators are gearing up. We'll get to a point in 10 years or so where biological simulators won't just replace human testing, but will actually replace many of the levels of testing before that. We'll make that whole process more efficient. But regulation is an issue. We haven't talked much about the downside of these technologies. I alluded to it briefly when I commented on Bill Joy, but a bioterrorist doesn't have to put his or her invention through the FDA. The scientists we're counting on to defend us do. I mentioned I'm on the advisory board for the Army. The Army is the institution in the country responsible for bioterrorism. And the real specter, which gets very little discussion, which I've given testimony in Congress on, is not just things like anthrax and smallpox, but the ability to create a new biological virus that's completely human-made that would be stealthy, communicable, and deadly. Actually, the most important one is stealthy. And that's an existential threat. And the Army is very concerned about how to deal with regulation and basically what answers to the court. You can't really test these defenses. But I think we should put a few more stones on the defensive side of the scale. That was my proposal to Congress. We could create a system right now that actually would deal with this. We have the technology. We could have a system that would rapidly sequence a new virus, rapidly develop an RNA interference drug for it. We've shown repeatedly that RNA interference can stop viral infection for a specific identified virus, because the virus is a gene, and then rapidly gear up production. We could do that. We haven't done it. I think it will emerge naturally without an effort, but it'll take years longer. If it is a race, it would be good to actually move up the defense by several years.
Which companies are doing the interference RNA interference technology?
Well, there's a whole range of companies, and Genentech's been for United Therapeutics, which I'm on the board of. But United Therapeutics, but it's a whole industry now.
Okay. Thank you, Ray. That was terrific. A great start for Teledyne.
Is very exciting to me because I think it illuminates the fundamental economic models that will prevail increasingly on the Internet and explains the emergence of these logarithmic curves in e-commerce. And this is the long tail, and it's kind of a fulfillment of my dreams in life after television. But it's Chris Anderson, the editor of Wired, who has really come to grips with all the data about the long tail. And it's a thrilling story, and I hope it's going to be a thrilling book. Chris?
Thank you, George. So I am, as George says, writing a book. It's due today. And I may actually turn it in by the end of the month, so you're seeing me at the sort of frenetic last stage of writing this. Like Ray, my talk is got a lot of charts in it. The difference is that His is about science and technology, and mine's about culture and economics. And the other difference is that his exponentials all go up, and my exponentials all go down. You'll see what I mean in a moment. But what I'd like to do is give you a sort of a broad sense of framework. And this is broadly the economics of the 21st century, as I see them. And give you some examples of the businesses that will prosper from all this and the business models that will prosper. And then perhaps with George, we can drill down to some of the specifics. This is, I should mention, started as an article in Wired magazine in October of last year. It has subsequently become a research project with Harvard Business School, Stanford Business School, and MIT. The book is one manifestation. My blog, where we count some of our work, is another manifestation. And I'm hoping, and as I go on, I tailor it to specific industries, and it's been a fascinating travel through various industries to see how this new economic model applies. I work for Condé Nast. Condé Nast is a premier magazine publisher. We have Vogue and Vanity Fair and Self and Allure and The New Yorker. And we are in the hit business. We're at the very top of the sort of cultural food chain. And we're all about sort of picking stars and anointing them and driving mass culture. Our audiences are typically numbered, each magazine typically numbered in the millions. So as I say, we're in the hits business, and so I know the hits business well. The 20th century has been defined by the hits business. But it's been defined for the hits business not because of a cultural demand for hits, but as I spent time researching this subject, it's been defined as a hits business because of economics. The economic rules of the 20th century are largely rules of scarcity. Shelf space is expensive. Inventory, holding goods in stores and elsewhere, is expensive. Spectrum, radio channels, television channels, even the carrying capacity of a coax cable is expensive. And marketing is very expensive. Most of Hollywood's budget, at least half of Hollywood hit budget, will go to marketing. It's all very, very expensive. And when the economics of distribution are very expensive, you focus on the products that will make the best use of the channels you've got, and those are hits. Hits, because they can aggregate audiences, because they can aggregate consumers in big, big lump sums, they use these distribution channels very efficiently. It costs money to get things out there, so you want to get things out there that will sell the most. They aggregate audiences. Hits are defined by their ability to pull a lot of people around a single thing, a product, a movie, a television show. And they benefit from network effects in the sense that once people start talking about it, you get this water cooler effect, you get buzz, and you get an increasing returns and accelerating returns sort of a marketing effect where a little bit of priming of the pump in marketing with the right product and a lot of this distribution can turn into a kind of cultural phenomenon which feeds on itself. It's a very efficient use of the medium. When you make a hit, you do what in Hollywood here, you can either find something brilliant, transcendental, marvelous, and pluck that thing out of the ether and deliver it through this channel to people who will appreciate it. Or, because that's very hard, you can just follow certain formulas and shove a relatively traditional product that is guaranteed to push the right button also through this channel. And, as you know, Hollywood uses stars, special effects, action, and some relatively formulaic scripts because that's the easier method than trying to find diamonds in the rough. And that defines, sadly, our culture in many ways today. If you're in the hits business, you can imagine those executives sweating, looking for the next big thing in the boardroom suites of music labels and television studios and Hollywood boardrooms. It is, you're trying to guess at what people are going to want. You need the easiest way to guess at what people are going to want is to find things that many people, find places where many people's interests are shared. You need to find things that cross demographic and cultural boundaries, that's more likely to strike a chord. You try to guess what people want now. You try to guess what's going to be in tomorrow based on what's in today. You very quickly cull, eliminate handful of shows that aren't showing that right traction instantaneously. And you limit your choice because you can't spread many bets out this way. Every one of those bets is expensive. The channel is expensive. You have to be very, very discriminating about what you get out there. The rules of distribution are changing. The economics of distribution are changing, largely because of information effects. The Internet is the best example, but it's largely derived from digital economics overall. Shelf space for digital products is, of course, unlimited. These are entries in the database. They're bits over a network. They don't have the same economic cost of atoms gathering dust on a shelf. The inventory costs, again, are entries in the database. They're negligible. Spectrum in a multicast world where you're delivering bits over networks from either a person to a person or from an institution to a person, spectrum isn't really the issue anymore. You're not in the broadcast paradigm anymore. You're in the sort of single cast paradigm. And in the single cast paradigm, you have not just 500 channels or a million channels, you have an infinite number of channels. So the cost per channel becomes an irrelevancy. And finally, marketing, which we think of as being something out of the advertising world, where you pay for a 30-second ad for billboards when you push messages out to the masses. Marketing in this environment, in the digital economy, becomes much more of a word of mouth, amplified when everyone has a megaphone. Blogs are an example of marketing. Chatter, buzz, organically coming from people who found something they like and want to tell people about it, that has the same effect as marketing. And the way we see this is with something like Google. What Google does is it measures the wisdom of the crowd. It measures what people are talking about. And then when people search for something, it then plucks that wisdom out of its whole index of all the Internet and delivers that as the top entry on the list. That is, as you know, there's two ways to get to the top entry of that list. You can either pay for it with traditional marketing, or you can offer something that is so relevant that the collective intelligence of all those users out there have already found it. They've linked to it. And Google measures those links and translates that into relevancy, and then suddenly you get what amounts to marketing at zero cost to the person who created that page or that product that everyone has discovered and thinks so highly of. What this means, though, in the 21st, in these digital economics, is that rather than focusing on hits, you can focus on niches. Not that hits go away, but that you now suddenly have a second market, a market of niches that coexists with the hits that was never really noticed before. And broadly, another way of describing this is that when your marginal costs, manufacturing distribution, are very, very low, you don't have to be discriminating anymore about what you get out there. You don't have to guess and choose and predict what people are going to want in search of that blockbuster, in search of the next big hit. Instead, you can toss everything out there, let the marketplace sort it out, and let niches be niches, and customers find the ones they like. This is the part where I do exponentials as well, but they're different. This is a power law. It's the inverse of what Ray talks about. It's rather than something raised to the power, it's raised to the minus power. It's 1/x is an example. And what this shape is the shape of the economies we know today. This is every market you can think of looks exactly like that. If you imagine the vertical axis is sales and the horizontal axis is products, you have the hits on the left, and then you have the non-hits, the misses, the other stuff on the right. And it is a picture of inequity. A few hits sell like a lot, and a lot of non-hits sell not a lot, and you mostly hear about the stuff on the left and never hear about the stuff on the right. And this could apply to jam, it could apply to television shows, it could apply to shoe sales. Virtually every market exhibits this sort of shape. If you plot it log-log, and I know at this point I don't have to define what log-log is, you get a straight line. This is, again, the natural shape of 20th century, of commerce of any sort. This is the natural shape of a market. It's a power law. expresses. It's log-log as a straight line. Unless it isn't. This is actual data. This is Hollywood box office from 1999 to 2002. It should be a straight line, and it is a straight line for a while, until suddenly it falls off a cliff. You can probably guess at what's happening there where it falls off a cliff. Sorry? Ishtar, yes, exactly. You need a few more of those to explain it. The presumption would be that movies suddenly suck. At some point along there, the movies just ran out of ideas. They ran out of talent. They ran out of everything, and you end up with Ishtar. That's not the case. The reason they run out, the reason that curve falls off a cliff, is because they ran out of screens. They ran out of movie theater screens. There were only so many movie theater screens, and a small number of films, less than 300 films per year. As you can see, the line's about 900 over a three-year period. So fewer than 300 films a year get distribution. Now, they don't just make 300 films a year. There are something like 15,000 films released every year in film festivals in the United States. But what happens is that only a tiny fraction of those films make it onto screens. And if you don't make it onto the screen, you don't have any box office. And if you don't have any box office, you fall off a cliff. And if, for all intents and purposes, you don't exist anymore. Films get cut off, just like that. As you can see, you have a traditional power law, just like everywhere else. You have some films do better than other films, and they fall off very rapidly. But at a certain point, it just gets whacked. No more films. No more screens. No more theatrical distribution. No more box office. They don't stop making films there. As a matter of fact, you're looking at 10% of the films released over that period. But they stop distributing. So the curve is savagely truncated. This is the long tail. This is the alternative to what I just described. It derived. It started in early 2004 when I was talking to people in the online music business. I spoke initially to a guy named Ravi Vanandibe, who runs a digital jukebox company called eCast. A digital jukebox is like a jukebox in a bar with bubbles and neon lights, like a Wurlitzer. But the difference is, rather than having CDs, it's got a DSL connection, and rather than having 300 singles, you have 10,000. Or 20,000, or 30,000, depending on whatever you want. And what Robbie asked me, he said, what percentage of my top 10,000 tracks do you think sells at least once a month? And I knew this was a trick question, and I knew that the expected answer was going to be 20%, because we have the 80-20 rule, called Pareto's principle, and it's hardwired. 20% of everything accounts for all the sales, and the rest doesn't. I also knew the digital economics were different. And so I went way out on a limb, and I said, I'll bet 50% of your top 10,000 titles sell at least once a month. I was wrong. I was wildly wrong. And there's a copy of my original article, I think, in your bag, and go into a little more detail about this. The answer was 98%. Virtually all of the songs he had out there, 10,000, 20,000, 30,000, virtually all of them sold at least once a month. Now, some of them didn't sell a lot more than once a month, but they all sold at least once a month. And because the cost of storing them was effectively zero, and the cost of distributing them was effectively zero because they're digital bits in a database, there was no reason not to have 20, 30, 40,000. And that is what's different about this new economic model. I looked at a couple other examples. I figured, well, either there's something funky about digital jukeboxes, or we're really onto something here. So I looked at other examples of companies that also benefited from these extremely efficient economies of distribution. I went to Netflix, which has a large catalog of DVDs. It happens not to ship those DVDs in bits over a network, instead it sticks them in an envelope and puts them through the mail. However, its cost of inventory is very, very low. Centralized inventory, you search them on the website, you send them out over a fixed cost distribution network, which doesn't distinguish between hits and niches. That fixed cost distribution network is called the U.S. Mail. And they, too, have infinite shelf space. And they, too, showed 95% of their titles rented at least once a month. Amazon, I went to iTunes, I went to Rhapsody, the online music service, and in every instance, 95-98% of the titles they have sold at least once a month. Now, what's really amazing about this is that it didn't matter how many titles they had. Let me deconstruct this chart for you a little bit right here. The red part on the left represents the inventory of Walmart. Walmart is America's leading CD retailer. It, along with Best Buy and a few other big box stores, have driven out most of the independent music stores. They have about 4,300 CDs. That space that they're devoting to CDs is shrinking as they get more and more space over to DVDs and video games. There are, every year, 35,000 CDs are released. Walmart carries about 700 of them. The tiny, tiny fraction of the CDs available are available in Walmart, and yet Walmart is where most of the CDs in America are sold. So that, now, obviously, they pick the top-selling 700. In fact, they create the top-selling 700 each year. But they represent the market there in the red, and that is the majority of the market. It is not, however, the whole market. If you translate from CDs to tracks, the average of 12 or 13 tracks per CD, Walmart's about 50,000 tracks. By comparison, Rhapsody right now is about 1.2 million tracks. So in other words, tiny, tiny fraction, 4% of the music available is available in Walmart, and all the rest is only available on the online sites like Rhapsody, iTunes, Yahoo Music, and others. What we're seeing there is a huge expansion in availability, a huge expansion of variety and choice. Now you could guess that, well, look, you know, Walmart has got the top 5,000 CDs. This is clearly what the world wants, the best-selling ones. You know, presumably, those other CDs that were below the 5,000, you know, people wanted them, they'd be in Walmart. That is certainly the way Walmart thinks. And the way Best Buy thinks. And it is certainly true that none of them sell as many as the ones in the top 5,000. However, they do sell. They sell in 10,000, 20,000, 30,000. They don't sell in the millions necessarily, but there are so many of them that in aggregate, they add up to a market that is starting to rival the market we already know. The pie charts show the size of the relative markets, the hits in red and the niches in yellow, the hits being the inventory that Rhapsody has and Walmart has, and the yellow being the inventory that only Rhapsody has. As you can see, in a year, it's gone from 23% of Rhapsody's total sales to 28% of Rhapsody's sales. It looks like it's asymptotically going to approach about a half of the market. What that says, just to make you realize what we're looking at here, is that the market for stuff that is not available in Walmart looks like it's going to be about as big as the market for stuff that is available in Walmart. In other words, the markets that we know through the bricks and mortar retailers are just half of the potential market. And we're just now being able to tap that new potential market of an infinite number of niches through these long-tail businesses that are able to have infinite shelf space effectively. What's cool about this is that these niches, we have assumed that the economics of niches are worse. I mean, you know, obviously they don't have economies of scale. They don't aggregate audiences. They don't, you know, you don't have sort of, you know, one thing reaching everybody, amortizing your costs over a huge base. We've assumed that niches are inefficient. They're sub-economic. They're marginal. That's the reason they don't get onto shelf spaces. That's the reason they don't get on screens. That's the reason they don't get on our airwaves. However, it turns out that's not just wrong, it's way wrong. Digital economics are different. I'll start here with a DVD example. So this is a little complicated, so I'll walk you through it a little bit. It turns out the DVD business, especially the business of selling DVDs, which is, as you know, one of what's rescued Hollywood over the past few years, it's a really bad business. The problem being is that most of the sales happen in the first few weeks of the release of a DVD. The purple, the dark purple line represents what it costs a retailer to buy a DVD. The light, the blue line represents what the retailer can charge. As you can see, in the first 2 weeks of the release of a DVD, the cost is much higher than the sale price, and the margins are negative. Basically, Walmart loses somewhere between, Walmart loses somewhere between $3-$4 per DVD in those first few weeks of release. Now, why would they do that? They do it as it's obviously a loss leader. They do that because they can say that they've got the new robot DVD for $16, and indeed they do, and people come into the store, and they buy things that have better margins. However, they lose a lot of money. Now, over time, the price the studios charge for those DVDs falls pretty rapidly, and the price that Walmart charges does not fall as rapidly, and so the margins eventually go positive, and by the time a DVD is 24 months old, it's quite a profitable business. It's got a good, healthy 50% margin. However, if you go into a Blockbuster, you will notice that you don't see very many DVDs that are 24 months old. What you see is an entire wall full of the DVDs released this week, and they're stacked, 150 deep, because you need one copy per person, and they are promoted with big cardboard signs, and it's hard to find anything that isn't a new release. And the new releases account for more than 80% of the business in the DVD rental stores. So we have this huge. So if you think of new releases as being the hits and older titles as being the niches, you see that basically the DVD business we see right now is totally hit-centric, selling these new DVDs, renting these new DVDs, and yet the economics very much favor the older titles, the classics, the ones that have passed the test of time. This is a case where if you think of the older DVDs as the niches, and in fact they are in terms of sales, the economics are better. I'll give you another example. This is Netflix versus Blockbuster. Netflix has the left-hand scale is the acquisition cost of the DVD. The right-hand scale is the rating. In Netflix, after you rent a DVD, you're asked to rate it, 1 through 5 stars, I believe. And what you see there is that over time, the acquisition cost of a DVD goes down. So a DVD that's 2 years old is much cheaper for Netflix to acquire than one that's brand new. And what you also find is that the satisfaction of the DVD goes up over time. Why is that? Because obviously these are, a two-year-old DVD that you're renting is one that you have probably read good reviews about. Maybe it's been recommended to you. It's become a classic of sorts. It is now past its frothy marketing window. You're not being influenced by advertising. It's basically a DVD that has sort of proven itself. It is on its way to becoming a classic. The older DVDs just tend to be better. The ones that are still renting tend to be the ones that are good. So when you think about it, Blockbuster whose business is almost entirely there in the first 2 months, is paying the highest price for the lowest satisfaction. And Netflix is paying the lowest price for the highest satisfaction. And yet, why is Blockbuster in that business? Because unfortunately, the DVD industry, rental industry, is all about the Hollywood release cycle and marketing. And it's very, very hard, and there is no marketing for older titles. And because they have no other way to get you to rent a title than being able to promote it with a wall full of copies, that's the business they're in. However, Netflix is, although it also benefits from the Hollywood marketing cycle, it also benefits from search recommendations. It has a queue, so you can reserve something and you can get it months later. It remembers what you want. It remembers your taste. It has customer reviews. It has those rankings I just described. You can watch previews. All those kind of things you can't do in Blockbuster, you can do on Netflix. And therefore, it doesn't have to be also front-loaded towards the marketing cycle of Hollywood. You can instead emphasize the DVDs that people actually like and are recommended by people who they trust. So it's able to if Netflix is in the sweet spot of the industry, Blockbuster is unfortunately in the sour spot of the industry, which is why it's got some serious financial issues right now. I mentioned the 80-20 rule before, and as I say, the 80-20 rule is kind of the canonical definition of traditional markets. As you can see, it's the top row there. 20% of the product, represent 80% of the sale, and about 100% of the profit. Because, again, you have the economies of scale for the hit. Now go down to a long-tail business. That same 20% of the product now just represents 2% of the product because the long-tail retailer has such a larger inventory. You still have an 80-20 rule within that tiny section, but it only represents 10% of the overall business. You can see those two little bits on the bottom left. Because the margins are because you have the niches representing about half the business, you have a 50-25-25 distribution down there, where rather than those 20% of titles representing 80% of the sales, they only represent 50% of the sales on a long-tail business. And then finally, because the margins, as I just described, are so much better than niches, you have just a third of the profit are coming from those hits. So there you see the difference between a Walmart music business, which is 100% in those top 20% of titles, versus a Rhapsody-like business or an iTunes-like business, where only 30% of the profit comes from those top titles. And the rest comes from the stuff that's been considered sub-economic everywhere else. Are you talking about the upper one or the lower one? In the lower one. The gray, the gray corresponds to the gray above. So let's make up some numbers. So let's say that Walmart has 1,000 CDs, and that Rhapsody has 10,000 CDs. Okay. So for Walmart, 200 of those 1,000 CDs will count for 80% of its sales and 100% of its profit. Down to the bottom, those same 200 CDs represent just 2% of Rhapsody's business. The 800 CDs that are the rest of Walmart's business represent 8% of Rhapsody's business, and the stuff that Walmart doesn't carry, the other 9,000 CDs, represent the yellow bar and the rest of Rhapsody's business. So just the colors basically are aligned from top to bottom. So what makes a long tail? The first thing you need is you need variety. Obviously, you need a lot of stuff out there so you can expand your inventory. Variety of, the sort of abundance of stuff out there is being very much driven by what I call the democratization of the tools of production. And by that, I think blogs, think garage bands, think home video cameras. All this kind of stuff. Basically, anybody right now can become a movie maker, a musician, a publisher, a writer. There's just more stuff out there. So the tail moves to the right. There's more variety. The next thing you need to do is you've got to be able to get to that variety. You need to lower the cost of consuming it. The internet is that. So if the PC was the tool that sort of lowered the cost of production, the internet is the tool that lowers the cost of consumption. And the effect of lowering the cost of consumption means there is more consumption out there in the niches. So that tends to raise the tail up. And then finally, you need to be able to sort of drive demand from the world people know of hits to the world they don't know of niches. And this involves things like recommendations, filters, search, word of mouth, all these kind of things that I'll be talking about a little bit more. But it's largely marketing in a long-tail economy. So you expand the tail to the right with more stuff. You raise the volume of the tail with the very efficient economics of internet distribution, and then you drive demand with all these sort of new relevancy tools that with Google being one of them, that are just now starting to get traction. For each one of those forces, there is a business that's emerging, an industry even that's emerging. As I mentioned, so for the democratization of production, those are the tool makers. And the producers who benefit from those tools. Lowering the cost of consumption, well, those are the aggregators, the Amazons, the iTunes of the world. And then there's the connecting consumers to drive demand, and those are the filters, the Googles of the world. And I'll give you some more examples right here. So to give you examples of the tool makers, you've got, Flickr is a photo sharing site, but it means that anybody out there can be a kind of professional, can be a popular photographer as they share their photos. TypePad, anyone can be a popular writer, a popular publisher. GarageBand, anyone can be a musician. a movie maker, anyone can be a movie, a filmmaker. Lulu is a print-on-demand service. Anyone can be a bookmaker. For the producers, to give you a different presentation of this, you know, on the left-hand side of the curve is the economics of stars. Stars are motivated, one presumes, by the appeal of wealth and fame and limousines and all this sort of stuff. They're largely motivated by money. And you know, imagine that people want to become a star so they become rich. It's not true for all of them, but that is our presumption about the economics of stars. In the middle of the curve, the people who beyond the sort of the blockbuster sellers, you have people who are motivated by things that aren't just money. When you think about it, most book writers don't write books to make money. People write books to get speeches. They write books to get tenure. They write books to find an audience. They write books to get consulting fees. They write books to be read. They write books to build the reputation. The book is a product, but it's not the way you make money. You make money around the product. And then finally, down on the right-hand side of the table, you have people who just do things because they want to. Most people who are in bands are not in bands because they expect to become Madonna, and are not in bands because they expect to quit their day jobs. They're in bands because they want to play music. They just want to express themselves. And one should never underestimate the power of individual expression allowed by these powerful tools of production that are just coming out there. What's very cool about that, about the changing incentives along the tail, is that from a consumer perspective, it doesn't matter. You don't care why they made the stuff. You just care whether you will want the stuff. And so, although the previous economics of distribution really favored the commercial model, you had to be signed by a label, you need to get a big advance, you need to get a marketing budget, you needed to be put on tour. That was the main way music got out there. Now you have an example where you can just remix a song in your bedroom, put it on iTunes. If it's good, people will start talking about it. People may even buy it. You don't have to be motivated by this kind of big machine that requires hits. Instead, you can be motivated by expression, but the consumers can receive your product all the same. That's how the economics of music change from the head to the tail. I mentioned also the aggregators. Most of the examples I gave, and I started the article in the entertainment industry because that's where the data is richest. The examples I gave, Amazon started as an aggregator of long-tailed books, now has something like 3 million titles. Netflix is an aggregator of DVDs. A typical blockbuster will have maybe 3,500 DVDs. Netflix now has approaching 50,000 DVDs. iTunes, I mentioned, you're looking at now 1.5 million songs compared to 50,000 in the retail environment. Google is aggregating, obviously, a lot of things. It's aggregating content. It's aggregating, not just words, but pictures and videos and audio. It's aggregating advertising, long-tailed advertisers, all those small niche advertisers who are buying individual keywords. And it's aggregating publishers, all those small niche publishers, blogs, many of them, who are running Google AdSense on their site. Again, all these people were below the economic threshold of the advertising, of the publishing, and of the printing business before. Now they're not. And eBay, of course, is an example of aggregating the long tail of physical goods. Most of the stuff that you saw, that's not true. Most of the stuff that's on eBay is stuff that's not available in Walmart. It's not necessarily most of the sales on eBay, but it is most of the stuff. There's a lot more stuff that isn't in the traditional retail markets than there is in it. And finally, filters, which is a very, very big theme. I'll be talking more about that in my remaining time. But examples of that are collaborative filtering. This is the Amazon. If you like X, you might, people who like X also like Y. PageRank, which is the Google algorithm, is an example of filtering. Blogs have a kind of a collective filtering. They find good stuff and they bring it to your attention. Playlists or in music is an example of other people's tastes as a filter to introduce you to new stuff. And reviews and rankings are also examples of filters that tend to find quality out there and bring it and raise it, bring it to your attention. Really quickly, just a little bit more about filters. Filters are super important to long-tail markets. As I say, with a long-tail market without good filters is just noise. And the reason is it looks like this. When you think about it, A little bit of stuff sells a lot, and a lot of stuff sells a little. So you basically have more stuff on the low selling side than you do on the high selling side. So in other words, we have these inverted curves. And if you express this, if you're into information theory, you want to express in terms of signal noise ratios, it goes like this. The red line sort of says that, well, basically, what you're looking for, signal noise, think of it this way. You're looking for, let's take music. You're looking for ambient industrial techno. Now, there is very little ambient industrial techno. Let me express this another way. As you go down the tail, there's more and more stuff. The fraction of this that is ambient industrial techno is very, very small. You can think of that as a signal, as declining signal to noise ratio. The stuff you don't want overwhelms the stuff you do want. However, you are not willing to deal with a noisier signal than that dotted line there. Basically, if you can't find it in 2 minutes, you're not willing to go any further. So the tools that help you find stuff have to get more and more powerful as you move down the tail to keep that 2 minute rule constant. So as there's more stuff in the tail, and therefore your filters have to become more powerful as you go down the tail to continue to maintain a kind of constant and easy level of findability. There's a lot of fallacies that we think about when you think about the tail. One thing people think is well, you know, if it isn't selling well, it must not be good. The long tail is clearly, you know, must be full of crap, right? Because if it was good, it would sell well. Well, this is what I call headism or hitism. And it's really the wrong way to think about it. What you realize is that the stuff at the head is stuff that tends to be for lots of people. In other words, it tends to address common interests. When the stuff at the tail tends to be for a few people, it addresses unique interests. Now, if you think about it, let's say you're into Greek history. You know, the best Greek history book is not going to be in the New York Times bestseller list. It's going to be down there in the tail. Now, it's not for everybody, but if you're into Greek history, it's really for you. And when you think about it, niches are all about narrow interests pursued deeply. And my thesis is that every one of us is niche in some part of our life. You may think you're mainstream music, mainstream television, mainstream movies, and then you're into model rocketry. Or you're into your family history, or you've got some interesting, or some, you know, some specific disease that you're following. In some part of our life, we want to go right down a tail and then go as deep as if you can. You have an infinite appetite in that particular niche. And what's interesting is that all of us have different niches that we have an infinite appetite in. So in a sense, you know, we all have a place down the tail, but we don't know where it is, and we need powerful tools to help us find it. So when you think about it, you know, the degree of satisfaction up there at the head, it's all pretty good. It ranges from okay to very good. And down the tail, it ranges from absolutely awful to absolutely brilliant. And it's not that the stuff gets worse down the tail, it's that the dynamic range of quality or satisfaction or relevancy to you gets wider in the tail. And the trick is, again, to find the good stuff, to find the diamonds in the rough and the needles in the haystack. In the 20th century, we also filtered, but we filtered ahead of time. We guessed at what people were going to want. So I'm an editor of a magazine, and every month I try to guess at what my readers are going to want. And I try to, and I pick subjects I think they're going to want, and I read the articles and edit them in a way I think they're going to want, and then I publish in our very scarce pages, and I hope that is in fact what they want. In the long tail market, you put it all out there, and you let the marketplace sort out what they want. You don't have to be discriminating. Likewise, in the music industry, those A&R guys in their limos are all about trying to guess at who's going to resonate, who's going to be popular. If you go onto a CD Baby or iTunes or more of the space MySpace, which is more to the point, MySpace is this extraordinary phenomenon of kind of grassroots independent music. You find bands that people have discovered and love and are raving about and are selling that no A&R guy has ever heard of. They didn't get pre-filtered, they got post-filtered. They put their stuff out there, and they were discovered not by some music industry guy in a ponytail, but by their peers. And that is a very, very powerful marketing function. It is effectively word of mouth. And finally, the department stores have buyers to try to guess at what people are going to want. That's their job, to guess and to predict and to filter ahead of time. Whereas if you go on to an Amazon or an eBay, where they basically put everything out there, instead you have actual buyers, you and me, who decide what we want. And the basis of our interests and of our choices economic work we're doing, one of the big questions is, as you expand the tail, what does it do to the shape of demand? You will still always have hits. This power law shape is absolutely fundamental to the human condition and to marketplaces. Whenever you have variety, lots of different stuff, and inequities, some of the stuff better than others, and network effects, which is that people, you get this sort of, word of mouth. People talk about the stuff that's good, and people talk about that, and you get this buzz factor. You will always have a fall off. But it doesn't have to be as sharp as it is today. And my theory is that the shape, as you expand the tail, that you get this flatter demand curve. Let me just show you one data point from some of our recent research. This is the online world and the offline world compared. The purple line is the Rhapsody data that I was showing you before. The blue line is SoundScan CD sales. So the purple line is online, the online market. The blue line is the offline market. And what you see is that when you normalize them, that the niches sell 2 to 3 times as well online. And this is even for stuff that is the same inventory that's available in Walmart and online. The same songs, the same CDs sell better online. So why is that? Let's just start with the shared inventory. It's a much better buying experience. In the online world, you have recommendations that can turn you on to stuff you wouldn't find anywhere. You can listen to it. You can sample it. You can find out infinite amount of information about it. You can read reviews. You can read about the band. You can search. You can follow other people's playlists. And, more importantly, you can see what other people are doing. You can tap the wisdom of the crowd. If you can find it within my particular niche genre, again, that industrial techno, I can see what other people are into this are buying right now. All that information Walmart knows but doesn't share with you. You can't search in Walmart. You can't have recommendations. You can't see what's best-selling in this genre right now at Walmart. The CDs are there, but you can't find them. Online, you can find them. And what's more is that the CDs keep going, and that flatter demand curve keeps going. That's what accounts for the greater aggregate sales in the long tail. Another quick chart just to show you the fact that the hits are much less dominant online. A quick reminder that it's not just about entertainment, as I mentioned. And then finally, to get to my guilder influence part of this. We're talking about basically the economics of abundance. The 21st century is about scarcity. The 20th century is about scarcity. The 21st is about abundance, and that is the long tail. We're not wasting transistors. We're wasting storage and bandwidth, a Gilder-esque phrase, and we end up with this, the abundant future where you can have anything, anytime, and lots of people choose that option. Thank you.
So what does this mean about the cable industry or Verizon's effort to enter the cable industry?
So television turns out to be a fascinating example of an industry that's going to be transformed by the long tail. It is the industry that has the highest ratio of content not available to content available. So when you think about it, when a television show is released, it sort of kind of pops out there. Maybe it's on for a week, and then it's gone. If you didn't set your TiVo to record it, you can't watch it. Now, a tiny fraction of that TV might go into syndication. A tiny fraction might show up on DVD later. But the vast majority of TV has this brief moment in the sun and then disappears. So you say, well, that TV that didn't find the requisite big audience, the double-digit market share, that's long-tail TV. There was an audience for it. It just wasn't big enough for the economics of the cable industry. So the cable industry and the telco industry's perspective on this is they're like, okay, we get it. We're going to do video on demand.
Right.
So we're going to set up these big servers, and we're going to let you buy these things from our library. And the biggest library I think I've found is a couple thousand shows. There are millions of shows out there. So the problem is that they have this very kind of closed network model. We're going to put the content, we're going to sign a deal, you'll have an exclusive deal, it'll be Comcast only, you have the content on our server, you're going to pay for it according to our rate base, and we'll do this exclusive deal. The alternative, of course, is video on demand over the Internet.
Well, Comcast's most profitable service is
It's internet access. That's it.
Right, exactly.
Which suggests the long tail invading the cable industry.
Right, and they're going to have a problem with it. That there's going to be two ways to get the same video. You can buy it from Comcast their way, or you can get it off the internet over the same line, by a third party.
We can have a couple questions that we're really getting. Andy? Here's Andy. We're getting a microphone for you.
That's a big Gresham's law, where bad content drives out good, and that, in fact, filters sort of have to be filters have to grow in ability and so forth faster at some level than supply, or you have a bad product driving out good. I think Filmizer gave that example. I used to see 20 movies a year, and I'm pretty close. I'm a few years away from seeing zero, because it's just it's sort of at its function. There are just so many bad movies.
Well, this is a very frequently heard concern, and we used to hear this a lot about the internet. Back in the old days, you'd say, there's so much crap out there. How can you find anything? And then we had Google, and now nobody worries. When it says 5 million results. Return, you don't care. You only care about the first page. And so, my sense is that there's no evidence that the filters are not keeping up with demand. Now, there are certain, broadly, there are certainly instances where you don't find what you want on the first page of results or the second page of results, and they have not, in fact, in that instance, kept up in demand. And I think that represents an opportunity for what I call fine slice filters. So maybe what you don't need is a music filter. Maybe you want a country music filter, or maybe you want an alt-country music filter. And so there's all these opportunities to really kind of, in the search example, the vertical search, all these opportunities to really zero in for people who are into this stuff to give them more and more relevant results. So, my sense is the Google model seems to be scalable, seems to be winning the war against noise out there, and I have no reason to think that model won't apply elsewhere.
One more. What? Back in the...
Hi. Two quick interrelated...
Who are you?
Fred Weber. Two quick interrelated things. One, on your Netflix versus Blockbuster, I was very interested to know if you have the data. You sort of made the statement that they get to sell the content later when it's cheaper. But do they, in fact, get to buy it when it's cheaper? Because my assumption is they need to buy right at the beginning as well so that the customers who are Netflix customers can get the Blockbusters at the beginning.
Good question. So I do have the data. I can't share it with you, but what I will tell you is I'll tell you the answer to your question. They underbuy. They underbuy the hits. And what you'll notice is that they will sometimes push things down the queue, push a new release down the queue and give it to you a little later. They'll force you to wait. They'll tell you it's not available. They have made a trade-off. They've made a bet that their customers will tolerate that in a way the Blockbuster customers will not tolerate that, because their customers are more interested in the sort of residual, lasting value and can wait. And then, basically, because they're getting the DVD by mail, and therefore it's a two-day delay, they're already kind of have stated that they're willing to accept some delay. And so Netflix maybe underbuys by 50%.
Right, so they're able to optimize the business by understanding that model.
Precisely. And they balance, by the way, they balance the customer satisfaction from that underbuying with their churn rate, churn being the kind of big risk in that business. And they just try to get it quite right to maximize that.
And then I guess very closely related, you at one point said that anybody can become a movie maker. And there's no question that at some level anyone can become a movie maker because of the cheap digital camera, which is very different from the distribution. At the same time, the cost of production of many things is still going up rapidly in many places. And the long tail doesn't really help you because your chances of winning are still very low. And you get a little return, but you can only invest so much unless you know you're going to get a hit.
Right. Well, my kids were watching yesterday afternoon, what they chose to watch, out of everything that's on television, all the DVDs, they chose to watch something called the Codex series. The Codex series is a machinima movie made with the Halo game engine by... there's 20 episodes. It's absolutely brilliant. The kids love it. Unfortunately, it will not be many more than 20 episodes because the producers went to college. They're all 17. Their cost of production was effectively zero. The Xboxes they already had and VHS recorder. My kids' second favorite shows are snowboarding videos. Snowboarding videos are just, again, camcorder watching people do stupid stunts. None of these people, none of these producers are in it to make money. Some of them are in it because it's fun. Some of them are in it because they do it with their friends. And some of them are in it because they want to get a career someday in the movie industry, and this is a great marketing vehicle for them.
Well, thank you very much. Life after television, this is here. We got a book signing downstairs somewhere. Where is it, Mary? What? Oh, it says.
Bullwhacker's Pub.
Oh, Bullwhacker's Pub, okay.
Which is located downstairs. If you go to the main lobby, take the stairs to the bottom level. That's where we'll be at. Thank you. Have a good night.
guess we can stop recording right now. Okay.